Bienvenidos a un nuevo episodio del podcast de K-Fan, un espacio en el que aprender de emprendedores que han creado, escalado y a veces vendido empresas tecnológicas.
Bitance es una app de bienestar que protege a tus empleados y les anima a vivir mejor. A través de divertidos retos por equipos, competirán en actividades físicas y de mindfulness y ganarán recompensas por ello. Descubre cómo Bitance puede mejorar el bienestar de tu empresa en bitance.com.
Hey Max, how are you, man?
I'm good, man. How are you doing?
you were expecting a different intro. I like that. Before we introduce Ichazu, who's our real guest today, can you, since it's the first time you're on the podcast, can you explain a bit who you are and what
do
you do here?
Is. You're the first
person in the K-Fan team with an English accent, so
yeah, I'm flying the flag of pale Northern Europeans. I'm Max Bray. I've joined K-Fund as essentially head of platform, but I'm doing a bit of a role spanning building out what a platform looks like at K, helping on some internal ops, and also helping on different bits of investments. So kind of trying my hand at all sorts of different bits of the K machine. And I'm very excited to be also helping you on our first English language English language podcast with English people present. So yeah, really excited to get started.
I gotta say that our English copies have never been as good as they have been in the past few months since you've joined. So hey, our guest today is Ichazu del Palacio, who's a partner at Notion, a London-based fund that invests all over Europe. Is that right, Ichazu?
Yeah, that's it. Hi man and Max, great to be here today.
Thank you for coming, because we know you're a busy woman, so thank you for coming.
We always make time for you.
Actually, I mean, we'll go into, I think, one of your key themes, which is PLG, or product-led growth. But we've talked to a couple of people who know you well, and both of them mentioned to bring up a topic, which is like kind of personal more than professional, which is that one, you have a PhD, and you can explain a bit what that PhD is on, and you're a teacher about entrepreneurship, if I'm not wrong. And on top of that you're also like a professor of spinning, so you teach spinning, is that right?
Yes, who did you talk with?
Many people. We have our sources.
Those are small secrets. Small secrets. So I do the first one. I do have, they're pretty different. Both are teaching, mm-hmm. but quite different stuff. I do have a PhD. I'm an engineer by background, and I work for Daimler, the car manufacturer, early in my career, which was probably the most boring thing I've ever done in my life. And so after a year and a half working as an engineer there, I really love tutoring kids on the side. So I really wanted to teach. And so doing a PhD would allow me to teach at university. And that's how I went back, did a master's in engineering, and I started my PhD. And in fact, that is the way I moved from engineering to entrepreneurship, because at the time, the UPC, the Technical University in Barcelona, where engineers were studying there, had set up the first technology transfer office to help students build companies and work with businesses with the technology. And they wanted them to learn from the best universities around the world, and that took me to Silicon Valley. And I went and I did a research at UC Berkeley. So I was there for several years, wrote my papers and my dissertation with a professor there whose name is Jerry Engel. Today he's an emeritus professor. He's almost retired there, but exceptional man. And we basically did analysis around entrepreneurial ecosystems and how the different stakeholders interact with each other to help universities build companies. And so from that, I've been teaching since then. Obviously, I teach entrepreneurial finance, and that's what I do. So since I came to London, I've been I taught over 3,500, 4,000 students in entrepreneurship, entrepreneurial finance. So they are, let's say, everywhere, popping up everywhere. We have invested in some of them, and it is a passion for me to teach those super entrepreneurial students, and I teach at UCL, University College London, in London. Not UCLA, as some people think when I say UCL. Yeah.
The better one.
Exactly, the better
the
one.
The weather is different.
The weather is a little bit different. Yeah.
One question on this before you go into other things, Itazu. Why did you do that? I mean, you're probably busy with Notion already, and you're probably not doing it to get deal flow for the firm. So why did you do this?
And I don't do it for money, as you can imagine. Education is not what gives you money, for sure. You forgot that one. So it is a very simple answer. I absolutely love teaching, and I love to see how can I help those students build their companies and reduce risk on their processes. To be honest, I almost help them get the confidence they need just to get out and start building businesses. And I'm so passionate about it that I think it's very contagious, this type of back, right? And so it is a matter of giving back to the market and to the industry, yes.
And maybe one that leads into then the kind of your day job, as it were. What do you think you take from that into being an investor at Notion? What are the transferable areas?
Yeah, definitely we hire people. My students, we have two of the people in the team were my students before. We've invested in several companies that are in our portfolio, and they were founders and they were my students of mine, sorry. And that's a little bit what I get from that. And I get, honestly, if you realize professors at universities are always keeping themselves very young, and they work for a long time. And the reality is that you keep learning, and that enthusiasm of the students is something incredible that brings you up to a speed very quickly. It lets me understand what are the tools that all these millennials are using nonstop, right? So it is incredible, and I absolutely love it, to be very honest. So yeah.
Where does the spinning come into play? I mean, you actually I
didn't forget that one.
Yeah. No, because you actually mentioned something that also came up in some of our previous conversations about you, which is that you mentioned like professors being fresh and looking young for a long time, and someone, I think this was Chris, Chris mentioned that you not only have like a strong work ethic, but you work out a lot, so you do a lot of sports activities. What do you do?
Yes. I mean, I love exercising in general, but I do at this moment, there are three main things that I usually do, or three or four. I do a lot of boxing. I am really addicted to boxing. I love it. I do a lot of running. I've been doing a lot of running for many, many years, and it really clears up my mind, and I absolutely love that. I'm doing a little bit of swimming. I'm very bad at it, very bad. And I keep trying, but I continue to be very bad at it. But I love it. It gives me this good feeling. And the last one is the spinning that you are mentioning. I've been, I exercise every single day. I'm a 6 a.m. Wake up type of person. 7 a.m. By 7 a.m., I'm at the gym. By 8:30, you can be at the office, and you had your whole day of clearing up your mind for you and making you ready for the day. I think I'm a productivity freak. Chris says that I work a lot. I do, but I don't feel that way just because of the workouts. I started teaching spinning 8 years ago, and I still do it on Monday and Friday, 7 a.m., so it's pretty simple. You go to the gym, and instead of paying to go, they pay you to go. So it's pretty great, right? You just reverse the business model. That's the dream of many people.
For our London listeners, where can they find you spinning?
They can. I teach at Virgin Active. I teach at the moment. I'm teaching at Bank, Virgin Active Bank, and Virgin Active Islington, Monday and Friday. So anyone that wants to show up, and you will not be the first one, because many entrepreneurs and investors come once in a while, which is great to see people, to be honest. Right. Really great.
Come to pitch. Exactly. So you mentioned that you're a productivity freak. This was not in the agenda, but I think that I think every single VC struggles with productivity or calendar management and stuff like that. What tips do you have there? What thing works good for you that maybe others could apply in terms of productivity besides working out? So more like work.
Yes, I'm not an expert, but things that have worked for me and tips that I can give to people. Definitely, I've limited my first calls with founders to half an hour, and I try to leave the rest of the half an hour of that hour free, so that you can do a couple of emails, you can catch up with the follow-ups. So that's one of the things. In order to fit it in a half an hour, I do have a template when I talk to founders. I use always the same
template. You showed it to the founders, or did you just follow it without showing it?
I just show it. I just follow it without showing it. I show it with our investment team here, everybody we hire. I show it because I think it might help them. But it is a good way to make sure you are touching in every point in a very consistent way, and you don't waste time, because otherwise in half an hour you don't have time. The third thing I try to do is I try to pass businesses. If it is not a good fit, the best moment to say that is just on the call. Don't leave it for later. Don't need to send a long email about it. And in fact, founders get it really well, because you are like, hey, I don't want to waste your time. I'm not going to ask you to send me 5 documents afterwards and be chasing for me, because I already know this is not going to work. So the reason it's not going to work is because of this, and usually it's the fit with the firm or the space. You are not super enthusiastic about it, or there are some small things, but you can say it, and founders really appreciate it, because they are like, okay, fine, done, quick feedback, and it really saves a lot of time. So I think these three things are probably three things that I try to do and help me the most.
Do you limit the number of like startup calls or founder calls you do per day or per week, so you're not in a back-to-back-to-back every single day?
No, and that's a mistake.
Well, it's hard, I think.
It's hard, but it is, And everyone within the team, we have a very hungry investment team, and everyone is like, oh, I saw this, you got to see that, and you can jump on a call with me and this thing, and, you know, they get excited.
Well, I guess it's also a matter, I think it happens to us as well. It's also a matter of like, which I think is something common with VCs, like FOMO, like fear of missing out. I guess it's very hard to be confident about not taking a call just in case that someone or that company is the one that becomes like a fund returner or something like that. I think it's a constant struggle. Yeah.
You are absolutely right. And the point I just mentioned about passing on the call is you need to go over that FOMO if you are passing on the call, because then you are not taking the time to look at the documents and so on. But let's be realistic. How long does it take to look at all these documents, and how much dragging it is in that process?
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jaime, maybe this moves into the area we're talking about, funding environment stuff, and then we could move to products after that. There's a question that we were wondering about before is when you're a big like brand name fund like Notion, and you're investing internationally, when you're writing those smaller tickets, how do you think about the responsibility you have in terms of follow on? Because obviously if you're seen to not follow on with a business, that can be seen as a big red flag to other funds. So does it change how you think about writing smaller tickets or following when you have a brand name like Notion behind you?
And I think just one thing, Ichazo, yes. I think it makes sense, because I think it's a very good question. I think it makes sense for you to explain like 1 minute, I mean, how big the firm is, what kind of checks you write, and what are these small checks that Max is references into.
Perfect. Yes, I will do that. So Notion is a is a B2B SaaS investor. We are now investing from our fifth fund, and it is a 250 plus million fund investing across Europe. Same thing as we've been doing for the last 13, 15 years, SaaS, cloud, staff. So we haven't changed. And it, while it sounds boring, I think it's more exciting than ever. But we definitely pioneered that space. And talking about pioneering, we do have those earlier stage checks where we put very small tickets. So our sweet spot is Series A, but we are doing very small tickets of 50K checks in a lot of companies in such a way that we give them access to our platform team. And for those, and our platform resources, for those who don't know Notion very well, Notion is very strong. We've been very strong, and we've been putting a lot of resources on building our platform team in such a way that we help our companies building the SaaS, the go-to-market engine. How do you set up the go-to-market, the sales, the marketing? How do you scale that? How do you go internationally? And on the other side, we help them with talent. And Max, I think, was mentioning that he just met Michelle, our head of talent, and she's very hands-on with our companies. So what about if we give access to many smaller companies to those resources, as we do events, as we do a lot of talks, and we have a network of experts? And so we started putting 50K checks 18 months ago. At the moment, we have over 80 companies in these pioneers' early stage portfolio. We hadn't had any issue on the follow-on signaling. That is what Jaime is asking, for different reasons. One of the main ones is that we are a Series A investor. And when those companies are raising usually a seed investment or a pre-seed even investment, because they are very early, they can justify easily that we are waiting until the Series A, that they are not at the metrics. So to date, we had not had any issue with that in that sense.
Yeah, and you said, Chaso, that you make Series A checks. What kind of checks? I mean, what kind of size? Because Series A changes a lot, like who you ask.
Yes, between $2 and $8 million US dollars. I'm still talking in terms of prior to this slowdown of the market. I don't know what is going to happen, to be frank. And we do some Series B, in fact, usually up to 10 million in Series B if they are not massive Series Bs. And
on the slowdown of the market, what are your thoughts there? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about, obviously, like the contraction in public market multiples, like being notable also at Series C, well, growth stage. But now there's a lot of talk about it being noticed as well at the early stage, so A's and seed, and well, B's, A's and seed. What do you make of that? Have you guys noticed any slowdown?
Of course, we have. I think many companies are trying to avoid going to market and raising money, and so, which I don't blame them, because everyone is trying to figure out whether in fact the market will even go lower. Because let me tell you, there is no better time to be investing than now, right? Let's put it this way. But companies are not going out because they know that the valuations, the multiples they are going to get, are not going to be the multiples they were expecting or they could have gotten maybe a year or a year and a half ago. And so the deal flow has slowed down, but there is definitely a massive opportunity for investors to be investing. And I tell you that I think a correction was absolutely needed in the market. It was absolutely needed because otherwise we can't get the returns that we need to give the returns to our investors. And therefore, we will not raise funds, and that will not benefit in the long term the venture and the technology ecosystem.
And when you think about those, either writing a first ticket at Series A or following on, have has the way in which you're thinking about the metrics you're looking at, the performance kind of KPIs of companies changed as the market has changed, or have you remained relatively consistent with that?
In terms of the Series A, we obviously, the companies that we've been looking that they have been brave enough to go out to raise money have stronger metrics than what we were seeing. And therefore, we are keen of seeing stronger metrics just because that is what we are seeing.
Yeah.
On the 50K checks, just to be clear, those 50K checks are a co-investment opportunities. So we never lead any of those deals. They are co-investment opportunities. We get no rights in those companies. Mm-hmm. So they are very plain, which means that allow us to work with many angel investors, with many early stage funds, and give them access to our platform go-to-market. That's it. And we help the companies raising money. We make a lot of introductions and so on. But we are not looking at metrics. We usually follow other investors. And if those investors we consider they are very good investors, then we will put the money in without looking at those metrics.
We didn't mention this. I think we didn't mention it, but you're actually from Spain. I believe Nation hasn't made a deal in Spain yet, I believe. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm wrong? Okay, I'm happy to be wrong in that one. But how do you see, I mean, you're obviously very well connected here in Spain. I mean, how do you see the market? I know this is a very general question, but
yeah.
A lot has changed, but what's your view?
I think I'm very optimistic. I've been optimistic about the Spanish market for the last 3 to 5 years has absolutely boomed. So I'm very optimistic about it. We've been putting more time on it. And I'm very, very optimistic. I think investors, they're very good investors. And if investors understand the terms of the investments are helping the companies, and those companies grow, there are several unicorns, people get that growth mindset. They leave those big companies and they build new companies. So the combination of the founders with a growth mindset and with a global perspective and good investors understanding the terms and understanding that they need to help those companies get money in the next round internationally. I think this combination is phenomenal for an ecosystem. I'm not getting even into the space that there is a lot of talent and so on, right? Because I think there is a lot of talent across Europe. But I'm very positive about it. We are just completing our first big investment in Spain.
Oh, nice.
Congratulations.
Ooh, but it hasn't been announced yet. So keep an eye on it.
Has it been signed?
Yes.
Okay, so good. Okay, so good. Congrats, and that's good news.
Yes.
And when you think about the Spanish market, Chaso, are there areas, like when you think about the UK, right, you think like deep tech or you think fintech or you think certain areas where we have kind of standout talent businesses, scaled businesses with like mafias coming that are spinning out of those businesses. Are there any areas that you look at in Spain and you're like, that's an area that either there is an existing strength or an area where you're like, actually, there's real potential to have a kind of standout area for Spain there?
So, good question. You know, I think there are some very good product founders in Spain. I mean, we just saw, and congrats, K-Fund guys, we just saw Factorial raising money. Great example, Jordi, incredibly product-driven founder. And many other companies, they are genuinely good product people in Spain. And I really like that. And I think that might be a matter of I don't know where the reason is why people are good at product, but that could be a reason of if you want to sell internationally, you notice from my accent, we are not the best sales English speaking people. And so if you have an amazing product though, you can't really sell through the product. And you can really convince people through that product. And I think that could be one thing. And another thing, it could also be that, and we can move to talk, you mentioned at the beginning that you wanted to talk about product let grow, mm-hmm. and we can talk about that in a second. But I also think that many companies in Spain have raised maybe smaller rounds of funding at the very beginning. And so they get very creative in the way they acquire customers. And I found really good SEO people in Spain, for example. Very good people who are doing efficient marketing. And through efficient marketing and inbound and organic traffic, you can build good traction and qualified leads through the product. And so I think that is a strength and an interesting angle for many Spanish founders, in fact.
I guess that's the positive side of the coin. I guess the other side of the coin is that, and we see that, and we think about this many, several times per month when we think about investments, is that pre-seed and seed money in Spain is not, I mean, the pre-seed or seed rounds that you can raise in Spain sometimes are not as big as obviously the ones in the US, but not just the US, but Northern European. And obviously, if you're building like a global product, you're competing with those guys. You're not competing with the Spanish guys. So do you think, Ichazo, that puts you, or sometimes can put like Spanish companies as a disadvantage when it comes to very competitive market where, I mean, not because you don't have enough resources to grow fast, but obviously, I mean, the implications that has on dilution, on the kind of getting faster to a Series A when things get serious. I mean, how do you think about the sizes of pre-seed and seed?
Yeah, I don't know exactly the sizes. As you said, I'm Spanish, but I live mm-hmm. in London. I've been for a long time here, and we don't do pre-seed and seed rounds usually. So I don't know exactly where are they today. But it is true that one of the weaknesses that I found in businesses when I've been looking at businesses in Spain is that many of them are look a lot or sell to local markets for too long. And maybe that's this is one of the reasons. If you don't have resources to build an international, localize your product and build an international sales or marketing or presence, obviously that is difficult, right? And so, yeah, I've seen that, and that might be a reason. I can't say it for sure, but it could be a reason.
So,
go ahead, Max.
So, if you were going to flip that, if you're going to flip that on its head, then and think about, I'm a first-time Spanish founder. I'm looking to build a business that has international potential. I want to raise money from top Spanish and potentially international funds. What kind of advice would you be giving those founders to make themselves look attractive to international investors to be able to take that business? Because I think you're completely right. It's a smaller market and a market with obviously a different language to other European countries, and it can be very easy for founders to get stuck in the Spanish market. What pieces of advice would you give those founders?
Yeah, definitely. I would definitely tell the founders that they need to have a global mindset from start. You can't be pitching something that sounds, this is Spanish. It needs to sound global from start. And it can be because you have some beta testers, and those beta testers, you have 20 of them, and guess what? 18 or 19 are outside Spain. That is making me think that you are not going even to beta testers in Spain. You are looking for feedback internationally and for mm-hmm. reaching an international market. If those 20 beta testers are 20 companies in Spain, that probably doesn't give me the perception that you are thinking of building an international market. I'm just using a very early stage sample, but if you translate that to Series A, obviously I'm looking for companies who have already sold. Sold internationally.
So it's not just I think actually we've been speaking to founders recently who are they obviously all say yeah we're starting in Spain and then we'd love to do France and we'd love to do Portugal and Germany, but it's actually not just talking the talk there, it's walking that walk from a very early stage of building that global mindset into your product from kind of day zero.
Correct, exactly that. And in fact, fantastic. Even building the team, if you build a team with international people, even if they are in Spain or outside, whatever it is, that is going to give that product and that business an international mindset from a start.
Chaso, moving into the PLG topic, I mean, what does explain to the audience? I mean, I think most of the audience will be familiar with the term. Well, what does product like growth mean? And then we can go. Yeah. I think you published a very interesting article about the six secrets of building a PLG business, and we can go through those six. But what is PLG?
So PLG, product led growth, it is basically the idea of having people buy products or acquire, get familiar and engage with new products by themselves. So they don't need a salesperson for that. So it is the opportunity for companies to engage with their users and their customers through their product, acquire users and customers, engage with them, expand, and build loyalty through the product. And that sounds like, what are you talking about? But there is some, in the past, I heard someone who said that when you go to buy something to the store, you basically can try something before you buy it, right? And in fact, when you do that, imagine if you translate that into a B2B SaaS solution, which is what we invest in and what PLG refers to. You go to a store and you say, hey, I want to try those shoes. And the lady at the store tells you, what's your email address? And you say, no, I want to try the shoes. And the lady is, but what is your email address and your phone number? Let me complete the form before. And you are like, that just doesn't work, right? So how can you let your customers play, your users play with the product before even they buy, right? Before they put any email address, because in many cases, you need to create the account, even in product-led growth businesses where you can onboard yourself on the product, you need to put the email address before you even use the product, which I think it is this onboarding friction that happens. Mm. But basically, that's what it is. I think the future, I mean, Jaime, Max, tell me, do you like when a salesperson is calling you, trying to sell you something?
I think
it makes me see red.
Exactly. So you hang up, you tell them you cannot talk. So I think salespeople have a very tough job targeting users and customers without having a lead or an indication that these people are looking to change. And that is very difficult. So how do you use your product to build what are called product qualified leads? Basically, people that you have identified because they are using the product, that they could be buyers. And then maybe you can call them. Obviously, you can onboard them by themselves. But if you want to go to the next step and sell to them and sell enterprise solutions, which is also in parallel or product-led growth or self-serve, you can also sell enterprise solutions. You can do that, but you know already there are 10 people at that company using that product consistently. And when you are calling, you say, hey, there are 10 of our users are from your company. They are using it on a daily basis. Now we can give you a better price if you want to do an enterprise deal. And that's what product-led growth is.
Aside from maybe the like decacorns and the unicorns that we all know, what would be some great examples of companies you think are doing this really well at the moment?
I mean, Factorial is one of them. I don't want to go back to it, but any of the companies that you guys can imagine of the Notion or Airtable, or there is a company in France that. We are working very close with called Folk, F-O-L-K, Folk mm-hmm. app. And it's very basically, yes, a bottom up. Solution, a new CRM era. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that the one that's actually a Spanish company, although a lot of people do not know that it's a Spanish company, it's probably one of the main exponents of product-like growth in Spain, is actually Typeform.
Correct.
Which is, it's actually, and it's actually a different kind of play in product-like growth, which is that you actually many times know about the company because you respond to one of the forms. not because mm-hmm. you're actually trying the product. And the way you respond to the forms and the way the offboarding at the end of the survey is made leads you to try the to discover what Typeform is and actually discover the product, sign up, and all that kind of stuff. So it's like a completing the flywheel.
Correct. And a viral element, right? Because if you want mm-hmm. to acquire customers through the product, that is the way to basically engage with them and to let your own customers, let other people know that this product, in fact, is great.
Yeah. So you had in this article, it has those six secrets to building a PLG business. The first one is born, not made. What do you mean by that?
I would say that to be product-led growth, it's much easier if you are born with the PLG mentality than if you are a sales organization and then try to implement product-led growth. I have not seen many companies that can do that well.
So it's a founder thing.
No. It is a founder, it's a mentality, it's an organizational structure. And it is also that if your product is not ready to be onboarded, self-serve onboarded, then probably it's going to be very difficult for you to change that in the future. And obviously that means you require sales team. There is a longer time to value, which is critical on PLG businesses. So yeah, Paddle in our portfolio is one of the companies that started sales led, and they moved to product led later on because there was a lot of education of the market to be done, and now they are basically ramping up. But they already had in mind that in the future they could be PLG.
And so then thinking about it, again, if we've got any founders listening who would be wanting to pitch you their businesses and whatever, you say to an extent it's nature, not nurture. But if I were a founder of an early stage business, what advice would you then be giving me from re-engineering my product really early, and also how to present that to you as an investor? What do you like to see from to kind of evidence PLG in business?
That's a great question, because in fact, if you think of PLG, the ACVs, the average contract values on PLG are very small, because people, the users go or take their credit card. And so in products like a Notion or an Airtable or those products, you might pay what, $10, $20 per user.
Yeah.
So while the ACVs in SaaS, are you can get 20, 50, 150 ACVs, right? And so by the time you get to 1 million ARR on a PLG business, you might be even much bigger on a sales led. And also remember that in a sales led, you might sell a product without building. You go to somebody, you're talking to them, and you tell them, hey, this is what we are going to build. You sign the contract, yep. And then you use that money to build the product. On product-led growth, that is not possible. So the lag, the time between the setup of the company and the moment that company really scale up on revenue is much longer. And so for investors, it's a shocker. Unless they understand those metrics, it's like, well, what are you talking about? I mean, you are telling me your metrics are great and you are like at 100K ARR. What do you mean with that, right? And so you need to be able to, one, explain where those distractions coming from, what is the net retention rate of the customers that you have, how are they expanding, and how do you see that expanding in the future, right? The virality coefficient, which is what Jaime was talking about, right? How many people do get on the product as a result of yourself using the product? Mm-hmm. How many other people do you bring? And all those metrics are very important, which are not necessarily the revenue metric, but those are very important when you talk to investors.
So to continue with the list, Ichazo, the second one that you have here is value-based pricing. You touched on freemium before, but explain a bit more about what you mean by value-based.
Yeah, just to be clear, product-led growth doesn't equal freemium or free trial. It doesn't. Product-led growth might not have a freemium or free trial product. That's, they might not, right? It is the fact that you can start using the product by yourself without a Buka demo or something like that. And so if you are charging by usage, it is a much more valuable, and users start feeling the value of that usage. And I think it is the best companies in our portfolio which are doing product-led growth. For example, in that article I mentioned, Test Gorilla, they are charging per test that they provide to employers so that they can test their employees, right? And I think that is probably the best way to feel the value and to be able to scale. It's a little bit like the AWS or Google Cloud. You scale when you pay more, when you scale the usage, and you don't feel you are paying for it when you are not using it. And that is a fair value.
And one of the areas we were actually speaking to a business about this the other day, of I think a lot of earlier stage SaaS companies struggle with is pricing, right? And how you, especially when, as you talk about, a lot of these product-led growth businesses are almost defining new categories, right? It's like there are a lot of more horizontal, lower transaction value businesses. When you're working with a founder and you're either seeing that their pricing's way off or they need help with that, how do you, and you obviously talk also about Notion's platform capabilities around this, how do you guys think about pricing for these product-led businesses? Is there like a, do you have a kind of matrix around it? Do you go from successful examples? What are the frameworks you use to think about that?
I mean, you always need to look at what these people are paying for similar tools. It might not be competitors, sure, but for similar tools, so that it gives you an understanding of what is what they are paying. But I would say you can also start raising that price a little bit and see where that basically gets to a plateau.
The elasticity of it.
Exactly. Losing users or customers, I would say, because of that, right? But yeah, definitely you need to test that because each product is different, I would say.
And you had one here that I had never thought about in the context of PLG, but I think it's super interesting. I mean, you've talked about building stickiness already, making products stick with customers. But you had one here on number five, which is personalization. And how, in a way, like building specific ways of onboarding users drives you to usage and to the famous like aha moment. What examples have you seen out there about personalization? And how do you think about that when assessing businesses?
Yeah, so I love that one. I really love that one. And it was, I discussed it a lot with the founder of Gredel, Martí, who he's a Spanish founder. And I really love that one because in some cases, when you land on a product and that product, because of the way you have been able to sign in on it, can extract data from your CRM, from your contacts in LinkedIn, and can pre-populate a form with your own contacts, with your own information, with your own potential customers, it really feels this is for you, and you really see what should go in each of the spaces of this form, right? Instead of giving you a white canvas, it really, you land on the product, and in the way you enter the product, you are able already to start using it with your own data. And that is what I'm referring to on that. And Gredel is definitely doing that. I mentioned Fold before, and they have a lot of templates. And so in many of those places, when you get to those, it really links it with your information, and you can start using those based on your data.
And last but not least, number six, you mentioned real PLG. What's the fake PLG then?
The fake PLG is the most common PLG. How many companies? I mean, PLG is in fashion, you tell me, Jaime. So everyone wants to do PLG. And so the fake PLG is like, yeah, we are doing PLG, but no, we are having a call with all customers. Just a quick one. Just a quick one, just to make sure they stay, right? And in fact, And I think a part of doing that is a little bit, founders are sometimes scared they will lose that customer because they will not be able to use the product, which means they don't have enough confidence on their product, right, to drive that. And two, they might not have the patience to wait until they have a product that really is self-onboarding and has no friction at all. And so they start offering the product. And so they, it is not really for that self-onboarding. They start onboarding people, and then the product people take over other responsibilities that are not the onboarding, because we can already onboard them. So now let's work on two other things. And so that becomes a fake PLG.
So on the real and fake PLG, I mean, what's your take on this? Just what I'm going to say. I think that, I mean, you have, for example, examples like Slack or Typeform. So for example, Typeform was, I mean, I guess true PLG up until, I think they're now 60 million ARR or something like that. But now when you try to sign up for the product, the freemium is very limited. They're layering a sales organization on top of the real PLG motion. This happened as well with Slack. So when companies get to a certain scale, like tens of millions in ARR, usually there's like this tendency or tension to need to layer enterprise sales or mid-market sales on top of the PLG motion to get to, I don't know, 100 million ARR, 1 billion ARR in the case of Slack and those guys. So do you think PLG gets you to a certain point? It always plays a role, or how do you think about that in the combination? You mentioned before, like, PLG doesn't mean enterprise sales, but how do you think about this?
I believe that to build a 100, 150 million business, you need to combine PLG and sales. So I do think that the best way or the fastest way to build a business is basically by combining PLG and sales, both of them. You mentioned the other, they reduce the things that, or the features, or the trial timing for the free versions. As I said, I don't equal PLG on freemium or free trial. So I don't really care how long it's free, as far as they can continue using it by themselves, the product. So I think it's a very good way to continue growing, and I don't think these companies are moving away from product qualified leads and from adoption of the customers through product.
Because yeah, when you think about those bigger examples, Typeform, Slack, for example, it's normally still there's an individual who starts using it within even an enterprise organization, right? And they'll beachhead in a specific team, and then it's actually that sales led growth comes in for the enterprise level product, not for your kind of 5 to 10 person startup who are still very much in that true product led growth approach.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. That's basically it, right? They enter through one, two users, and they can expand there through the sales team.
Yeah.
So one last question, Ichazo, before we move on to the two questions that we have for all guests. If I'm not mistaken, you're one of the few female VC partners in London, and in Europe in general. I mean, it's not super common. And you also, I mean, Notion has this program of which we're part of, which is called Included BC, which in a way is a way of opening the doors of BC to minorities and other types of people. I mean, talk a bit about your trajectory to this. I mean, how do you view the role, your role as one of the only female partners in London? Any tips for people who want to move into BC and are not from the typical background?
Yeah, I think I'm very optimistic. Honestly, they've been very few female partners in the past, but now it is growing little by little. You say few. Yeah, we are still few, but growing. So feeling optimistic about it. I do think fans have realized that, one, we bring a different perspective to the table. And the more diverse is the investment team, the more point of views and the more the better due diligence we are going to be able to do on those companies, right? And so I think that is pretty clear for everyone. Funds have also identified that, in fact, women or different ethnicities, nationalities, attract founders of those nationalities and of those that gender. So which means that we just by default receive more inbounds of women from than maybe other funds which are only led by male, just because people tend to like to talk to people who are similar to them, just because of that. Obviously, we are in the B2B SaaS space, which they are less women founders, but still, we get quite a good number of those, and I'm optimistic about it. So I would say, I would tell anyone, if you want to make that happen, just go for it. Think that you are bringing something positive to the table and believe that being a woman, in fact, is an asset.
And just as a very quick sub question of that, is what advice would you give to Spanish funds who have even fewer women, especially at senior levels, in attracting more women into venture?
Yeah, I think the problem, it is not in attracting women. The problem is on promoting these women.
Okay.
And the same way that I said you build connection with people who are like you, if the partnership is only established by men, they will build trust and relationships closer to other people who are similar to them and same nationality. And so breaking those barriers is important. It's important because you are going to feel uncomfortable with people who are going to challenge what you say because they don't see things from the same side of the table, from the same perspective. But you need to see that as a positive thing.
Brilliant.
Ichazo, last two questions. Can you recommend us a book or any other kind of content on any topic?
Absolutely.
Actually? And also suggest a person to invite to the podcast that we haven't had yet.
Yeah, so for those who know me, they know I'm a health freak. I love to be healthy. And there is something that I follow, which is around the circadian cycles, which is basically how do you optimize your health based on when you eat and when you sleep. And I know this is brutal for Spanish people, but basically the fact that you eat before the sun goes down, it's a very interesting concept to me. And you wake up when the sun comes out, and so we go earlier to bed and all of that, which I know in Spain that's not the norm. And so there's this book which is called The Circadian Code, which is about basically supercharging yourself by doing things at the right point in time. The author of the book is Sachin Panda, S-A-C-H-I-N, Panda. And he's a researcher at the Salk Institute in San Diego. And just following this guy has been a life changer for me, let me tell you.
Fantastic.
Incredible. And so in terms of people to recommend to speak, I would love to recommend someone who is a Spanish individual, worked with me at Microsoft because I ran M12 Microsoft Ventures in Europe before I joined Notion. Her name is Elisa García Anzano. And she just, in fact, left M12 Microsoft Ventures to join Meta. And she's doing everything related to AI business development and very close to corporate development too. She lives in California and she has been there for the last 10 years. I think she can give you a very good perspective on working with larger organizations but connected to the startups always. And yeah, I think she could be a good one.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
We'll ask for an intro because we don't have that contact. Chesso, this is a mute grade. So thanks a ton. Thanks to you, Max.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Great to see you.
Bye-bye.